So am I still waiting, waiting a long time,
waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to review, man.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. You're about to see something that you have never seen before. The Ultimate Fighting Challenge. Hello, I'm Bill Wallace, and welcome to McNichols Arena, in fabulous Denver, Colorado. Along with me is Jim Brown. I'd like to introduce you to what is called the Ultimate Fighting Challenge, to where they're having different fights, different types of disciplines, karate, judo, jiu-jitsu, savate, kickboxing, sumo wrestling, to where they have no holds barred, anything goes. Jim Brown, what do you think?
Bill, I've been around the toughest fighters in the world, Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier, Mike Tyson. I've been around the greatest NFL players, the tough guys, Dick Butkus, Sam Huff, all of those guys. But I'll tell you, they could not last in this ring.
Would you do it?
Would I do it? You mean
yes.
When I was in my prime?
Now.
You doggone right, I wouldn't do it.
Oh, come on.
Not a chance.
Oh, it's not that hard. Just remember, all you have to do is climb over the rope.
Welcome, everyone, to Review Away. My name is John Pollock, joined as always by Wei Ting. And I want to thank everybody for tuning into this edition of Review Away. For those that might be new, Wei, what do we do on this show?
Well, John, my name is Wei Ting, first of all. I'm your co-host on this program. And what we do on Review Away is we like to review, talk about, and analyze pro wrestling events from the past.
And today we're going to do that by reviewing mixed martial arts.
Yes.
And the very first UFC event from November of 1993, UFC 1, Wei, to coincide with UFC 129 here in Toronto this past weekend, mm-hmm. which you got to attend, setting numerous records, including the largest gate in mixed martial arts history, the highest paid attendance, and the show's probably going to do pretty well on pay-per-view as well. Tons of people in town for this. It was a huge event. So we were going to go look back to things when they weren't so rosy for the UFC. And that was here in Denver, Colorado, at the McNichols Sports Arena.
Mm.
So, Wei, let's get right into it, because this was a very unique show. At this point, Wei, I mean, it was basically promoted as no holds barred, two men enter, one leaves, stuff that would eventually haunt this company 4 years later, that would get them kicked off of pay-per-view.
Sorry, just to interrupt. You know what this was. This was like... this was promoted as like a pay-per-view spectacle.
Yes.
You know, like when they promote Jerry Springer Uncensored or Blind Date Uncensored on
Blind
pay-per-view.
Date Uncensored.
And they would like, I don't know, just throw nude shots in there. This was promoted like that. Come pay to see uncensored violence.
And this was the brainchild, everyone, of Bob Meyerowitz and Horian Gracie. And the original concept here was that this was designed to promote the Gracie Jiu-Jitsu and promote the Gracie family and their style of fighting.
Yes.
And this was to be basically an exhibition, a promotional
tool. An infomercial.
Pretty much. A three-hour infomercial for Gracie Jiu-Jitsu.
Now, how much of this, though, how much of that, you know, direction was known by the people putting this show on, or was it just Horry and kind of, you know, diverting things that way?
It was
himself?
You know what, I get more into this because later in the show we're going to be joined by Ken Shamrock to chat about this first show, and I asked him that question directly about how much this was known, the fact that Horian was not only promoting this, he was the matchmaker here. And Ken kind of goes into it about placement on the card of where who he was given in the first round, and some interesting stuff. So we'll get to that a little later on with Ken Shamrock. But the show kicks off, Wei, with an opening video of the eight competitors and their disciplines. And they were all going to be representing a discipline, whether it be the vaunted discipline of sumo, savate, kickboxing, karate, shoot fighting from Ken Shamrock, jiu-jitsu from Hoist Gracie. So all of this was going to be represented, and that was kind of their selling point, was that all along there had been these debates, you know, if a sumo wrestler fought a karate practitioner, which style would win out? And that's what they were selling here. It was less personalities and more these styles colliding.
This
what style would emerge the the most effective in a fighting environment.
This was blood sport, but done for real. This was a street fighter done for real.
We had our commentators, Bill Wallace.
Oh, boy.
And former Cleveland Brown, Jim Brown.
Uh-huh.
Wallace welcomes us to the Ultimate Fighting Challenge.
What a great start for this company that has just sold out 55,000 people, has done an incredible records as a sporting event. What an illustrious start to their beginnings. Ultimate Fighting Challenge.
This is Bill Wallace is a former kickboxer who actually got a mention by Joe Rogan on the UFC 129 pay-per-view on Saturday night.
What did he say?
He just brought up Bill Wallace and his kickboxing technique and said, early UFC commentator, Bill Wallace.
Wow.
There was a hilarious interplay between Wallace and Brown here. Wallace, I don't know if he was just choked up or what, but when he did his intro, he also burped.
Yeah, that was weird. This was weird, and it'll go down in history because this was so strange. He messes up the name of the show that he's hosting twice. He messed up twice.
Called it again, the Ultimate Fighting Challenge.
Yeah, and then he burps in the middle of his opening.
And they're also joined by five-time world kickboxing champion Kathy Long. What this woman added to this broadcast is beyond me.
Well, honestly,
she disappeared for every fight.
But I would say amongst the three, she seemed to bring, at least from what she said, the most credibility amongst the three of them.
You know, when I first rented this video when I was like 8, I thought...
You were 8 when you watched this?
Yeah, it would have been... No, this took place when I was 9, so I wouldn't have been 8. I rented this, though, like a year after it took place, so I would have been like 10 years old when I saw this.
And how did you get... What enticed you to rent this?
You know what it was? It was lined up with the wrestling videos at the video store.
Wow.
And I looked at it, and I realized this isn't pro wrestling, but this is something similar. There was a tournament format that I thought was interesting. I didn't know anybody on the card.
Mm-hmm.
But I watched it, and I thought, as someone that was 10 years old, tournament format was super... A guy wins, and then the two winners face, and then you go to the finals. It was very simple, and it was just carnage.
Did you have any idea what styles and what types
very
of
little.
Fighting
I didn't
see?
Know what jiu-jitsu was at the age of 10.
Yeah.
I just knew it was all these different forms of fighting,
okay.
And I found it really interesting.
Did you?
Age of 10.
But were you expecting when you popped the tape in to see like an actual worked, like not a worked match, but like a style, like a you know 10-minute match back and forth with its high spots and things like
that. I watched it more as it was something like boxing but was not boxing.
Okay.
The fact it was right there with the wrestling section, it appealed to me because it was similar.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, it was presented. I mean, the presentation of this was completely pro wrestling.
Well,
I mean, the way they tried to market these guys, and it would get more so with, you know, the chemos and stuff like that later on.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, I at that time when I watched it, I thought Jim Brown actually was someone that, I mean, at this point in time, he was considered like a tough guy by a lot of sports fans. And I think he was someone that was at least a familiar name to a sports fan to bring people in. Then they introduced us to their entire announce team, which was like 5 people deep. We went into the crowd with Rod Machado, who had the lamest joke on this show.
And also, I'd like to introduce you to Rod Machado. Tell us a little about the grappling that will happen.
You bet, Bill. Bill, you didn't ask me what my strategy would be for the fight, but if I
share
that with you, it would be to get out of the ring as quick as I possibly could.
And then he went on to talk about jiu-jitsu and the grappling aspect. Great.
Yeah.
Then Bill Wallace, continuing his tremendous run of pronunciation, said, well, now go to Brian Kilmeade in the ring. Brian Kilmeade then explained to us the structure of the octagon and was standing in it to show there was some give.
I recognize that guy from something else.
Me too.
Yeah.
I know he was on something else.
We keep marrying other species and other ethnics and other...
Are you sure they're not suffering from some of the causes of dementia right now?
See, the problem with getting the Swedes have pure genes. Because they marry other Swedes, because that's the rule. Finland, Finns marry other Finns, so they have a pure society. In America, we marry everybody.
Okay.
So we marry Italians and Irish.
So this study does not apply.
Does not apply to us.
Huh.
Yeah, go on while I look this up.
Then Bill Wallace was given the toughest task because he had to read the boards and explain the brackets. he couldn't read some of these names to save his life.
Oh, man.
We got the typical Royce Gracie, but as well, Taylor Tooley became Taylor Tooler.
The first fight will be Gerard Jardot against Taylor Tooley. Now we have a sumo wrestler against a savate player. The thing about Gerard is he also knows Muay Thai, which is a lot of very dangerous leg kicks. Taylor is 410 pounds. The second fight is Kevin Rozier against Zane Frazier. These two guys are both very, very experienced kickboxers. The third fight will be Royce Gracie, who is a jiu-jitsu expert, world champion, against Art Jimerson, who is a boxing person, ranked 10th in the world, IBF. The fourth fight will be Ken Shamrock, who is a shoot fighting, also does some wrestling, also does some taekwondo movements, against Patrick Smith, taekwondo practitioner, winner of the Sabaki Challenge here this last year, also Robitaille. The first match will be Gerard Jardot against Taylor Tooley.
So that takes us to our first fight way in UFC history.
By the way, Brian Kilmeade is a Fox News television personality. Weekdays, he co-hosts Fox's morning show, Fox and Friends.
Oh, dude, he does he's on Fox News. That's how I know him. Doesn't look like Brian Kilmore at all.
In 93, Kilmeade joined Brown as part of the announcing team for the inaugural UFC event, conducting post-fight interviews. He would move into play-by-play for UFC 2 and 3 in 94.
That guy, his clips always get run on The Daily Show. They always make fun of him.
Yeah. Okay.
So our first fight in UFC history way, Taylor Tooley, sumo wrestler, taking on Gerard Gordeau, who represented the discipline of savate.
Uh-huh.
Tooley, 6'2", 410 pounds from Hawaii.
Yeah.
There were no weight limits in this way, nor a weigh-in, I bet.
Nope.
Taking on Gordeau, who was 6'5", 216 pounds from the Netherlands.
Kickboxer.
Yes. And Bill Wallace, first of all, he describes the distance walking to the octagon.
Does he?
It is 75 feet of walking before the fight.
What is that going to do? The game plan.
Then fucking Bill Wallace, who was in desperate need of a fucking format sheet at this point, all night long he threw to Ron Goines in the ring, whose name is Rich Goines. It's like, we're going to go back to Ron Goines. This guy was horrible. He was just horrible.
He's terrible. And I don't know. I don't think they keyed him here, but like in the other UFCs, they would key him as the G-Man.
Yeah, the G-Man, yeah. Rich Goines.
The G-Man. Rich Goines.
Oh.
Off to a great start here.
They state that the two fighters had a meeting last night and agreed to have a bare-knuckle fight.
Yes.
Which is how things do not work today. They said that there's no groin shots, no eye gouging, and no biting, but everything else is okay.
Now, as an 8-year-old, 9-year-old child watching this, what, just, you were expecting a boxing type of fight, right? So you were expecting...
No, that. I expected this to be much less civil than a boxing fight. They marketed it as, you know, just complete carnage.
Did you expect at least, you know, battles, like wars, like a 10-minute, 9-minute, 6-minute war?
I don't think I knew what to expect here. I mean, this first fight went seconds here.
Yeah.
We saw...
They all did.
Yeah. None of the fights went the distance. Like, a lot of these guys, they didn't even know what they... Like, you had kickboxers their experience was fighting kickboxers. Mm-hmm. And now you're sent in with another discipline. You had one guy with one fucking boxing glove on. Like, these guys were clueless.
Yeah.
And...
Except Hoyce.
Except for Hoyce, and I would say except for Ken Shamrock, who was fighting overseas in Japan in Pancrase, which was at least familiar with all these different disciplines at the time. I mean, those were the two that kind of had an idea, I think, of what was expected here.
Mm-hmm.
So basically here, Tooley goes to bull Gordeau into the cage, and he just, like, runs at him and cannot stop, then takes a nasty kick to the face and a follow-up right, and it ends with a tooth of Tooley flying out into the crowd.
Yeah, what did it happen?
Teeth falling out, the lone link between UFC 1 and 129.
Yes, exactly. Tooley had basically, ran and then crashed into the cage, and so he was stuck in the corner of the cage, in the crevice of the cage, and while he was trying to get up, Gordeau just kicks him right in the face. We're talking soccer kick right
here. Yeah. This was an incredible kick here. Jim Brown's analysis was, I think he kicked him right in the face and lost a tooth.
Yeah.
And Bill Wallace was outraged, saying, this should continue. This should continue. And meanwhile, they don't know what's happening because the action is being stopped, and then the fight is actually stopped.
Well, it landed
awesome.
Squarely. No
awesome.
Question about that.
Tooth came out.
Yes. Kathy, did you catch that too?
No, I think it's under the table here.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to find it later, and I get a dollar for it. When I was little, you got a quarter.
Is that from the tooth fairy?
Oh, you start again?
You know what it looked like? It looked like, oh, man, like when this guy came, finally, like, walked up, you saw the camera saw the mess on this guy's face, and then the corner people, you could just see the look of horror on his cornerman's face, like, what did we just get into? What is this?
And this was what scared the shit out of guys backstage watching this.
Yeah.
And we have a story later of Art Jimerson, who literally was frightened by this. Zane Frazier is up next. Karate practitioner taking on kickboxer Kevin Rozier.
By the way, two of Thule's teeth were stuck in Gordo's foot.
Yeah, we heard this later. Like, this was gross.
Yeah.
And his teeth.
And they didn't take him out because they didn't want an open wound, basically. So they let the teeth in there.
You risked an infection to maybe get your foot amputated because of this teeth. Oh, disgusting.
He went on to fight with teeth.
He fought two more times. Oh, so Frazier and Rozier here. Rozier was 6'4", 265 pounds, a five-time kickboxing champion. Frazier, meanwhile, 6'6", 230 pounds. He was a Kempo karate practitioner. And he said in his pre-fight, they did these little 30-second video packages, Way, that were right out of like late-night television. And he said that God will give him the strength and courage to do the right things. And there was a confusion here because they met in the middle of the ring to start talking. And the announcers had no idea. Why are they talking? It was just interesting to watch the learning curve of the announcers on this show.
Yeah, yeah. Really, it was.
Rozier was stalking Frazier. He hit an overhand right and then a knee. He got the back of Frazier and then started delivering elbows to the back. Like, right onto the spine. This was gross.
Yeah.
Frazier gets Rozier against the cage, lands a low blow. Then he continues with knees, body shots. He is then pulling the hair of Rozier as he works for a headlock.
Yeah.
Frazier then hits an uppercut and a straight right. Frazier would get out of the clinching to connect. Both guys were getting so tired here, but Rozier was just completely gassed. Rozier lands these shots against the cage, and then these brutal shots to the back of the head, ending with a stomp to the back of the head of Zane Frazier.
Oh, it was insane.
He stomped the back of his head.
Yeah.
Fuck.
It sounds unreal to say. And in the commentary at this time, I think it was probably Wallace, it says, a lot of times in boxing, when you strike to the back of the head, it's illegal. But anything goes here. They were just so, like, they seemed so calm about it, you know? Like this is supposed to happen. This is part of the game. These are athletes. They're competitive.
It ended with the towel being thrown in. There were so many fouls in this fight that I lost count. It was this would never fly.
Yeah.
Fucking 2004, this wouldn't have flown.
Knees to a downed opponent.
Oh, this
everywhere.
Was just, this was like, this would make pride blush.
It really is. Yeah, this is.
Elbows to the spine.
I guess I never wonder why UFC never shows these clips in their highlight packages, because even when they're talking, like yesterday when they were talking about the history of the organization and everything, because this is embarrassing. It's embarrassing for what MMA is today.
As the announcers critiqued and analyzed the finish of this, it was almost like a comedy routine listening to these two.
Yeah.
Then we go back to Brian Kilmeade, who goes to talk to Kevin Rozier. Rozier says it felt like an hour in there. He thought Frazier punched himself out and had no idea what he was trying to do. And then he confessed, I'm a really bad interview. And we have Gordeau taking on Rozier in the semifinals. Up next, Royce Gracie, representing Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, was taking on the lone boxer in this tournament, Art Jimerson, who is strictly brought in here to showcase the Gracie Jiu-Jitsu mm-hmm. system against a, you know, middle of the wrong boxer. Here he was ranked by the IBF here.
It's because I think Horry and everybody thought that, you know, for the longest time.
Boxing is such a...
Yeah, in America, everybody thought that boxers like Muhammad Ali, Mike Tyson, were the toughest people on the planet. And I think Horry just wanted to exploit that by making an example of this ranked boxer, Art Jimerson.
Both fighters here, 6'1". Gracie was 180, Jimerson 196. Gracie got a very strong reaction here, and he was wearing a gi. So this was probably throwing off Mr. Jimerson, who was a fish out of water here. Jimerson was very tentative on his feet. Wallace, as Gracie got on top, Wallace noted, "It is no fun being underneath a jiu-jitsu, man." There's a double leg takedown by Gracie to get him down and easily gets into the mount, applies his hooks. Jimerson is just trying to maneuver out. Gracie has this very dominant position, and Jimerson becomes the first man to ever tap out from the mount position. That was the offensive maneuver from mount.
He was just so scared of anything. Like he might as well have been fighting a witch doctor, you know? Like, he felt like this guy could kill me.
I wanted to go, we'll go to our feedback later, but one piece of feedback I want to read now because it pertains to this fight. Dear John and Wei, did you know that Art Jimerson tapping out to nothing was actually Big John McCarthy's fault? Jimerson had a fight with Thomas Hearns scheduled a month after UFC 1 and
Hold on, Big John wasn't on the show.
He was backstage.
Oh.
He was backstage because he was one of Horian's students. And he tried to back out of the event once he learned the rules. But SEG offered him $20,000 just to show up, making him the highest paid fighter at UFC 1. The majority received $1,000 for an initial appearance. Jimerson was already shaken up after seeing Taylor Tooley lose several teeth and Zane Frazier sent to the hospital. Before the fight, John McCarthy was backstage and gave Jimerson a quick Brazilian jiu-jitsu demonstration, after which Jimerson said, "Oh my God, he's going to break my arms and legs, isn't he?" As a result, Jimerson's main aim was to leave the arena with his arms and legs still intact. Before the fight, Jimerson asked officials, "Do I tap with my left hand or my right hand?" Jimerson was so terrified by his demonstration with McCarthy that he tapped before Hoist could even pull off a submission hold. Jimerson's corner even tried to throw the towel in, but the towel caught onto the fence and the referee didn't see it. So I, for one, demand a Jimerson Gracie rematch at UFC Rio in August. And this is from an interview John McCarthy did with Fight Magazine a few years ago. An interesting little story there about Art Jimerson and his introduction to mixed martial arts.
That's right. Yes.
So
Art Jimerson, wow.
And we should note he was wearing one boxing glove here kept one hand free.
And what was the thing that happened recently where a guy wore one glove?
I don't recall this.
It made me think of Art Jimerson.
Oh, it was was it Tom Lawler at the weigh-ins? It was one guy.
He was pretending.
It was at the weigh-ins, and the guy Joe, and he wore one glove to the weigh-ins. You're right. Afterwards, some guy is on the desk here.
He was wearing one glove, by the way, to protect his hand.
Yeah, maybe he can catch him with a shot and protect his hand. That was his only hope. Because
he was supposed to fight Tommy Hearns just weeks after this or days after.
Yeah. Stats here on the desk, this random guy who just pulled out these statistics just mentions to us that there is a police department study that reveals 95% of fights end up on the ground. Great. And our fourth and final first round fight was Ken Shamrock representing Shoot Fighting taking on Patrick Smith, who was the lone Taekwondo artist. Wallace stated this is going to be the best fight of the round. And Shamrock here, he just looked nuts walking to the octagon. Like, he had a real presence about him. And then they went to his pre-fight video, which was like a male model video here, with a scripted promo, and was fighting for Pancras at the time.
Hi, my name is Ken Shamrock. I'm fighting in the Pancras organization out of Japan. I go 1 week each month and fight over there. My style consists of feet fighting, fist fighting, and ground technique. I think I'm going to win this fight because I am well adapted and I have many tools to go into the ring and use. I can fight on the ground and I can fight standing up. So I think this is my chance to win.
I'd imagine, Ken was probably pretty well versed in cutting promos even at this time, right?
Yes. Patrick Smith was the hometown favorite here, hailing from Denver, Colorado. We could see Bob Shamrock in the corner of Ken, and there's a great story Ken will share with us about Smith's entourage yelling at Bob Shamrock backstage before the show. Shamrock used a Greco-Roman clinch to get the takedown. He got on top into Smith's guard. Shamrock just postured up and started to land shots. Then Shamrock just leaned back into an ankle lock, and Smith just... He tried to get a toe lock himself, but really had no answer here. He was delivering elbows to the leg, but Smith had nothing here and just ended up tapped out. And Smith looked pissed after this fight. And Wallace suggests that no one wants to lose to a leg lock. There is no glory in that.
What?
There's no glory in being submitted on the ground.
What an idiot.
Kilmeade is with Shamrock afterwards. Shamrock says that this fight was easier than in Japan. There were chants of bullshit. Not exactly putting over this fight here. But Shamrock had flown over from Japan here. He had fought in Pancrase 3 days prior, and not only took a flight from Japan after a fight, but you're also in the altitude of Colorado here.
Yeah.
So a lot going against Ken Shamrock here, but getting his first round win, and that would set up Hoyce and Ken in the second round in what would be a very historic fight in UFC history.
That's right.
The announcers discussed the unfortunate... they start discussing the unfortunate part of the ground game because it's not that dramatic. Thanks, guys.
It sucks.
We go to the semifinals, and we got Gerard Gourdeau against Kevin Rozier. And they mentioned that Gourdeau broke his right hand in addition to his foot being taped up. So he threw two shots and broke two bones.
They zoom into a close-up of his hand, and his hand is like a ball. It's like it's the size of a tennis ball. Now he's fighting.
Amazing.
It was tough to watch.
They put a ton of Vaseline over the left eye of Rozier, who was cut open in his opening round fight. There were low leg kicks by Gourdeau. He connects with a straight right with his broken hand to drop Rozier. And then he kicks Rozier, who just huddles up into a ball in the corner. He's raining down, big right. Then he stomps him in the ribs, and he finishes the fight. Gourdeau was like a cyborg in this fight, and Gourdeau is going to the finals, stomping to the ribs.
It's amazing. With the teeth in his foot.
And then the announcers discussed the length of the fights, thinking that they thought they'd be longer because of strategy.
Yeah.
But instead, they've been very, very quick fights.
It was very clear to me watching the stream that I had that this was probably from the VHS, and I would say a very heavily edited VHS, because
there's no way these guys were coming back that quickly after their fights.
And also just from the flow of things, like they would cut from one angle to another, they would shorten entrances. So I wonder how much... how long the actual broadcast
was. Whole event was, what, like an hour and a half?
Yeah, so. Yeah, the video was. Yeah.
Rozier states afterwards he wants to come out of retirement, and he's going to come after the super heavyweight kickboxers. He says he trained 3 weeks for this event, blames the altitude, and didn't think any fight would last a five-minute round. And finally, he's asked why he can smile after two fights in 45 minutes, and he says, I lost 45 pounds in 3 weeks, and I want to come back to the UFC. Great.
Okay. Good luck.
The announcers discuss the next fight. They say it's unfortunate that this next fight isn't the finals, which is a great way to put over the fight they just saw. And they discuss the altitude once again, and no fighters coming early to acclimate themselves to the weather. Hoyce Gracie, Ken Shamrock. Gracie right away shot for a takedown, but Shamrock sprawled here.
Yeah.
Shamrock gets top position, but then Gracie reverses and gets on top from momentum, and he cuts off the room for Shamrock and gains the back of Shamrock, and he basically makes him tap right away, and you have to watch the replay to see that Gracie got a gi choke here, and he didn't want to let go because he wanted to make sure the referee saw him tap, and the ref basically asked Ken if he tapped here, and Ken admitted he did tap here. They shook hands at the end of this, but this caught a lot of people by surprise here with this gi choke, and suddenly Hoyce Gracie was going to the finals to face Gerard Gourdeau.
Hoyce had to basically shout at Ken, you tapped out, you know you did.
Yes.
And before Ken would
admit. Ken had to own up to it, and this was a fight that drove Ken mad. And he wanted to fight him again. And at UFC 3, they were both set to go to the finals when Hoyce injured himself against Chemo. And therefore, Hoyce pulled out. And therefore, Ken pulled out because he didn't want to go to the finals unless he was fighting unless he was fighting Hoyce Gracie. And that allowed Steve Jenham to go in and win the tournament. But they would fight again at UFC 5 in a show that would do gigantic business for the company.
At this point, was there somebody else that joined the commentary team? Because there is actually a guy that was very knowledgeable about jiu-jitsu.
This guy, Stats. I don't think it was that guy, Rod Machado. I think it was someone else all together. I wasn't really sure.
But he was basically the one that was explaining all the jiu-jitsu to Wallace.
It was interesting. At one point when that guy Rod Machado was in the crowd explaining grappling, a guy in the crowd put a rear naked choke on his girlfriend.
Yeah, I saw
that. It was just interesting to see in 93 someone applying that. Helio Gracie then got this ceremony where the audience booed him being honored here. So I guess they didn't like the break in the action. They presented Helio with an award, which was a very nice gesture. And Helio passed away just recently, January of 2009.
Yeah, Helio Gracie, the father of Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
Yes.
Yes. And so if there is ever more of a question as to what the show really was about.
You're right.
There you go.
And then our finals, everyone.
Hoyt and Gracie presenting, by the way.
Yes. The right foot of Gordeau is wrapped up here in the finals as they show the kick to the tooth of Thule. Taking on Hoyt Gracie, and Gordeau blocked the takedown, and then Gracie was clinching Gordeau against the cage. He eventually got the takedown into the mount. It was just like seamless how Gracie would get into mount position.
Yeah. Well, there was no such thing. I don't think they were even aware of what mount or guard was. And we even see in some of the earlier pancreases that we used to air on the Fight Network, there was nobody cared. They just like take my mount. What difference is
this? This is Gordeau, a kickboxer who we have no clue about this ground game.
Yeah.
No. And he quickly got the back of Gordeau. He worked and got the rear naked choke for the submission. Gordeau tried to fight it off, but again, Gracie does not let go, and he wants to make sure the ref sees this tap.
Yeah, he doesn't let go because the ref doesn't stop him. Yeah. Gordeau is tapping like 15 times, and the ref has no idea what to do. Like, he's never seen a tap. What are you doing? What is this gesture with your hand?
Yeah. So Gracie got the $50,000 prize and then said there was no pressure not to lose. His strategy was simply don't get hit. And this was UFC 1, the infamous UFC 1 way. And Hoyce Gracie was the star coming out of this. And I think a lot of people want to see a rematch with Ken Shamrock. They were the two personalities that are most associated with this event.
Yeah.
But this was the beginning of something very new and unique.
Mm-hmm.
And it would, as much as people look at this time period as the dark days, these were not dark days for the company. They did tremendously on pay-per-view up until like mid-96. And then in 97, they were thrown off pay-per-view. But without
television, by the way.
Exactly. Without television, something that you look at today, that's a recipe for death, is to go on pay-per-view without TV. But that UFC 5 mark, when you did Shamrock Gracie the rematch, it did 260,000 buys, which was a record until Chuck and Randy fought for the second time in February 2005.
Now,
that held for 9 years.
That's amazing. Now, when you think about that, can you really criticize the SEG for promoting this fight the way they did?
I mean, they promoted it. This was not meant to be something that was going to last for 10 years. It was just thrown out. They didn't even know if they'd do a second UFC. So if you had presented this as just legit sport and a kickboxing tournament or something, I don't think it would have gotten the attention that they had to sensationalize it. And you know what? It wasn't going to work over the long term, and it's caused the UFC to have to completely re-educate their audience, but they've done it. But for these early days, it worked in the short term. Mm-hmm. You can't deny that. Mm-hmm. There was definitely an audience that wanted to see this brutal form of combat sport.
Yeah, at least it got people talking and brought jiu-jitsu to the forefront of combat sports.
So that'll bring us to our interview, everybody. Someone that can talk about this firsthand, and that is Ken Shamrock, everybody, the UFC Hall of Famer, who was instrumental in the early days and really instrumental as well during their second boom in the mid-2000s. You take out his fight with Tito Ortiz, the UFC would have been shaped much differently. Hmm. I mean, that was their first fight in 2002. That was the glimmer of hope for the Fertittas and Dana White. So here we go, everyone. It's a lengthy one, so sit back and check it out. Ken Shamrock on Review Away. It's a pleasure right now to be joined by a man that really doesn't require any kind of introduction if you're a mixed martial arts enthusiast. He is a Hall of Famer, one of the biggest names in the history of mixed martial arts, and we thought it'd be a great time to have him back here on the show. It's a pleasure to welcome Ken Shamrock. And Ken, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, man. I really appreciate you guys calling, man. How are you guys doing?
We're doing well. And first of all, Ken, I want to get a bit of a health update because we understand you had a staph infection. You had to pull out of a fight this past weekend for World Extreme Fighting. How are you doing with the staph infection right now?
It's good. I went through a lot of family problems. My son had some medical problems, and we had to deal with those. And so he had an infection, which I ended up catching. But his was on the inside of his body, and mine was on the skin part of it, but it's very contagious, so I couldn't, my doctors advised me to stay out of it until the infection was completely gone. But right now, the infection is gone, and I feel healthy.
And are you expecting to be back in the gym probably in a week or so, or when do you hope to be back training?
Yeah, I think probably maybe 10 days. I'll be back in the gym again.
Well, that's great to hear, and uh,
Good to hear that. It's nothing too severe, unfortunately, having to pull out of that fight this past weekend. One of the major reasons we want to have you on, Ken, is that, of course, it's a huge week here in Toronto for mixed martial arts. It's going to be the very first UFC event being held at the Rogers Centre with 55,000 fans that are going to be in attendance for that show. And I think, you know, the name Ken Shamrock is inevitably a name that is always linked with the strong history of the UFC dating right back to 1993. When you hear of, you know, we've seen shows of this nature in Japan, but now coming over to North America, do you take a bit of a sense of pride at where mixed martial arts is right now? Because if you look at the two popularity peaks in the mid-90s in the UFC, and then conversely in the mid-2000s here, you are the common link there with your feuds with Royce Gracie as well as Tito Ortiz that really took UFC business to a different level.
Yeah, it did. You know, it's kind of fun to watch and see how it's developed. Unfortunately, I'm not involved with the UFC, and it's a shame because, you know, a lot of people help me do the things that I've done, and it would be nice. It's nice to sit and watch it and see it develop the way it is. You know, all these young fighters coming in and the talent that you see developed, it's amazing, man.
When was the last time, Ken, that you spoke to Dana White? And I mean, what is that relationship like right now? Is it non-existent at this point?
Yeah, you know, like I said, I'm not sure. We haven't spoken. I know he's busy doing shows. You know, they've got a pretty good schedule going. But yeah, like I said, I don't know where it stands. But you know, last where we left it off at wasn't too good. So hopefully, you know, when everything, the smoke clears and everything settles down and people start looking back on the history of the UFC, that, you know, we could bury some of these skeletons and move on.
I would hope so, Ken, because you are not just a piece of UFC history, but in my opinion, one of the most important people when it comes to the evolution of mixed martial arts in North America. And going back to that initial show, we were chatting about that this week, the very first UFC in November of 1993. And I'm curious how whether it be Bob Meyerowitz or was it Horry and Gracie that initially contacted you in your camp, and how did they initially sell you on this new concept, the Ultimate Fighting Championship?
Well, how it kind of evolved was that one of my students had seen either an advertisement of the UFC fighting, and it was basically no holds barred. Well, at that time, I was going over to Japan, and I was considered at that time one of the top foreigners fighting over in Japan. So when I saw this, I was excited because it was coming to the USA. So I contacted Art Davies, I guess was a matchmaker, and then once I contacted him, and they actually accepted me, because they only accepted, I believe, 8 fighters at the time, and I was one of the ones they accepted, and I went to Denver, Colorado. I was in Japan. I fought 3 days prior to. Never thought the thing was actually going to happen, because, you know, at that time here in the USA, having something like that, you know, was basically only saw it in movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I never really believed it was going to happen, but, you know, as we know now, it did, and it's really done well.
So tell us how you felt going into that first show. Ken, you mentioned that you had a pancreas fight just 3 days prior, so you're coming out of a fight, you have this giant flight from Japan, and as well, you have the altitude here in Denver, Colorado. I mean, you had a lot of things working against you on that first show. How did you feel going into it?
I did, you know, but in reality, you know, I really didn't believe it was going to happen.
Uh-huh.
You know, I just thought I'd get there and they would throw something in saying, well, this is how it's going to work. You can do this. You can't do that. So, you know, 3 days leading up to the fight, I was waiting for that that big kayfabe thing to come out, and it never did. So going into the fight, I really never really grasped the reality of what was going on until the day of the fight, and nothing changed. The fight was going to happen.
Did you find it was a pretty professionally run show, that first event in November of 93?
I thought it was excellent the way they ran it. They actually brought in some press. They did some interviews. They had some guys kicking and punching bags. And, you know, they had a press conference, and I thought it was really for the first show. They had everything put together really well. The only thing I thought that was probably a little bit unfair was the fact is that they had Horn and Gracie putting the fights together, when they were going to fight, at what time, and who was going to fight who. So, you know, but again, like I said, it was one of those things where, you know, it was an experience, and I think a lot of people had to find their way around. It's like walking in the dark trying to find a light switch, because it's never been done. Something like this never was done. So, you know, I was really happy to be a part of it and to have that experience. But after I had two or three fights, I kind of understood what was going on. And then, you know, that's when I actually started making my mark.
How did you feel after that first fight with Pat Smith? And coming out of that, did you get a better sense of what was going to be allowed inside of the octagon? Because at that point, it was really a gray area of what exactly are the rules here? And everyone was kind of, it was just trial by fire for these fighters on this card.
Well, the reality of it is when you hear no holds, no barred, man, anything goes, you know, really, it's hard to grasp that. Because I think most people are thinking like, you know, okay, no holds barred, anything goes, we can go in there and just, you know, do whatever we want. But, you know, our thoughts of competition and growing up is kicks, punches, knees, elbows, you know, all these things that we do in a street fight. So you basically just go into what you really understand, and your mind will allow you to understand. So, like, all these guys went in and fought and did what they thought was the best thing for them. But you didn't see the brutality that you know, like someone trying to poke someone's eyeball out, or someone, you know, kneeing somebody in the nuts, or, you know, just did something like fish hooking and all that stuff. It was all pretty much what was street fighting or regular boxing, kickboxing, or wrestling. So, you know, it was pretty amazing to me to see when you take all the rules out and you tell somebody do whatever you want, there's no time limit, on how much people have controls of their minds. They really don't understand the capability of what they can do.
You mentioned a bit about Horry and Gracie and the matchmaking on the show. I mean, since that show, I mean, there's been lots of interviews. Horry has even stated that kind of the initial premise of the UFC shows early on was to kind of be a marketing tool for Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. Was this pretty much well known at the time, or was this something that you didn't have too much knowledge of who Horry's Gracie was going into this first event and kind of what the purpose was for the UFC?
Yeah, well, no one understood. You know, we were basically brought in, and they were picking guys that they thought that would be a good match for Hoist and challenge him in a lot of different ways so that they could get out their basic jiu-jitsu and build their schools. It was brilliantly done, I thought. You know, when I first went in, they basically took my wrestling shoes away. If you watch the fight with Hoist, I sat back into a heel hook, and my feet were slipping as I was trying to secure the leg lock, and I had it.
Mm-hmm.
But because I didn't have the shoes, I wasn't able to push on the mat and get my hips around. And he was able to get back up on top and use his gi to choke me. And I asked him after the fight was over, Art Davies, and I go, why do you think that shoes are a weapon and a gi is not? And he couldn't answer me.
That's really interesting. Had you ever fought anyone with a gi up until that point?
No, it was kind of funny. I always thought it was a bunch of guys running around in pajamas, you know. I never really respected it. And when Hoist caught me with that gi choke, I started to study it because I never understood on how they could use that gi. And it was amazing once you got into it on how to use the gi. The thing to me, the most amazing thing to me was when they first did that event, The thought process of people going into this fight was like everybody was jacked up and that there was no fear and they were all tough guys. And when the first fight happened, it was Emmanuel Yarbo and, what's this guy from Holland?
It was
a ball-headed guy.
It was Gerard Gordeau.
Gerard Gordeau. the fight happens. I'm in the locker room, right? And everybody's hitting pads, and you know, the machismo, like screaming and pounding on their chests, and like they were gonna go out and destroy the world. And then when the first fight happened, Gerard Gadeau, Manny Arbo comes across the ring like he's gonna smash him into the fence. Arbo steps aside, hits him with a punch. He goes down to his knees, kicks him in the mouth. The teeth go flying in the front row. And I kid you not, it sounded like, a minute. It felt like a minute, but it was really only about a split second. Mm-hmm. But the announcers went silent, the crowd went silent, and the locker room went silent. And it was like slow motion. Like, people could not believe what they just saw. They saw this guy football kick a man on all four hands and knees, knocked his teeth into the front row, and landed in the announcer's laps. And then the announcer said, Superfoot Wallace says, "Oh my God, did you see that? The teeth landed in my lap." And all of a sudden, the crowd went wild, went nuts. The locker room, I kid you not, people started to really sweat. They could not believe what they just saw. Some guys were trying to back out of the fight. I mean, this was reality. People did not really understand that this was going to happen. It was never done in the United States before. The only time you saw this kind of stuff was in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was wild. Going into my first fight with Patrick Smith, I had some guys from Japan that flew down with me, going to work my corner, and my father was in my corner. And I know we were walking out to the ring. I was fighting Patrick Smith, and he had a bunch of guys stand in the hallway with red shirts on. And they were so gangster. I mean, they were pointing at me, screaming at me, telling me they were going to kill me. And
wow.
I remember my dad, as I'm walking in the ring, my dad has never been in a fight in his life. Went after his crew. I had to grab him and hold him back. And I was the one fighting. And I was like, "Hey, easy, Dad. I'm getting when I get in the ring. Let's get to the ring first."
So what was the, because after that fight, I mean, Smith looked just pissed in the octagon right after that. And I know there were some words exchanged. Was it more just his own frustration that you caught him? I mean, what was going on there after the first fight?
Yeah, I think he was a little bit frustrated. I really believe he thought he was going to get past me. He was going to get into the finals. But when I caught him in an ankle lock, one of the things that he had said during a pre-fight interview was that he could take all kinds of pain, that's his strength, that he will not tap out. And then when I caught him in the heel hook and he tapped out, I think that was kind of a real hard thing for him to swallow.
It's really interesting, Ken, at that time, because you had a really unique perspective, because you had delved a bit into professional wrestling at that point. And I know that after that very first UFC show, there was a lot of interest in kind of what is this new combat sport, because it almost seemed like here were elements of professional wrestling, but obviously legitimate fights at the time. And I think it was a lot of people thought it was almost like a morphing of the two, similar to what we saw in Japan with Pancrase, with the UWFI, and what then actualized with Pride at the top level.
Well, it was interesting, too, because, in most fights, you have things that you can't do. Boxing, of course, stand-up, right? You can't go to the ground. Well, then when you get into the grappling stuff or wrestling or whatever, it's basically on the ground, There's no punching, no striking, standing up, takedowns. So here was this sport now where they could actually do all these things and put them into one event. And it was exciting. It wasn't boring. I mean, it was no lull in the action. I mean, it was constant fighting. Everywhere you could stand in the ring or lay down in the ring, there was constant fighting. And so this was an entertainment now in which you didn't have to have a set finish or a set beginning or to work the match out to make it exciting for the fans. This was something that was exciting and it was real.
And that was just so unique about it, I think, at the time for so many people who it was a lot of questions for the fighters and the audience as well, that it was just they had a great hook to bring people in. And then it was just this very, very unique product. Tell us a bit about coming out of the Gracie fight, Ken. I mean, was that a loss that really ate at you at the time? I mean, did you leave with a bit of a more appreciation for Brazilian jiu-jitsu, kind of this this unknown discipline that was introduced on that first UFC show to a wide audience?
It was something, whenever you get into something and you get beat, you need to understand how you get beat, and then you go back and you say, okay, I'm going to figure out how that happened, and it's not going to happen again. And you really work at it so it doesn't happen again. And the one thing that I think probably ate at me the most was the fact is that I didn't take him serious. And I've seen this over and over again about people that get into a position where they win and they've won a lot, and then they start taking advantage of the idea that they don't have to really take anything serious. I saw about 160 or 170 pound guy wearing a gi, and I basically just discredited him and just said, you know what, I can walk right through this guy. Well, anytime you do that, and we've all learned over the past that that's when you usually get caught and you lose. I promised it would never happen again. And in the UFC, I've only been submitted one time. Mm-hmm. And that was in the very beginning of Royce Gracie, and I fought him again, and I promised it would never happen again, and that I would beat him.
One of the most interesting aspects, Ken, when I look at, you know, the path that you really led for a lot of fighters is that today's mixed martial arts camp is your traditional 10-week camp where people have it down to a science of when they're going to peak their body, what they're going to do on a day-by-day basis. You have schedules, you have coaches. At your time, Ken, a lot of it was just trial and error at the time of, you know, what could we put our bodies through training-wise? How many fights can we put our bodies through? How much recovery time there was going to be? I mean, you were really with a group of fighters, basically with a flashlight, going into this cave that was completely dark, and no one knew what the template was for training in what would become mixed martial arts.
And with that being said, you know, having all those things in there, and the worst thing was trying to find people to train with you, because
sure,
there wasn't a whole bunch of guys around that you could go in and go, okay, we're going to do this mixed martial arts thing. Either they were strikers or they were wrestlers, and no one really had an idea of mixing them together. And then when you tried to do that, people were going, no, I don't do that. You know, that's not what I do. I just do this. And so finding guys, you know, was crazy. That's why I developed the Lion's Den. And when I was in Japan, because I had no one here in the States to train with, so I came up with the Lion's Den, you know, King of the Jungle, and started developing talent so I could have guys to train with.
And who were some of those key guys, Ken, that you relied on the most at that time?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, the starting out, I had guys like Vernon White, Jerry Bolander, Frank Shamrock, Pete Williams, Guy Mesger, you know, Mikey Burnett, Joe Hurley, you know, and every one of those guys became world champions. So, you know, I thought that training with them guys helped me out a lot, but obviously it also helped the team.
Frank has always stated that he never once saw you get tapped in practice. Is that a true story, Ken?
Yeah, I never got tapped. But again, like I said, I was going with guys that the sport was so young, and that it was very difficult to find guys that were doing both, and I was teaching them. So, it was young at the time, and there wasn't too many guys who were that great. I went with Oleg a few times, and I think as far as submissions, he was probably one of the better guys. But, you know, he never tapped me. But, yeah, I was, you know, like I said, I was very, very good at what I did. I was able to help out quite a few guys to get to their goals.
What was tougher for you, Ken, that loss to Hoist at UFC 1 or at UFC 3 where you were scheduled to fight him in the finals and then Hoist pulled out to not make it to the finals? I mean, was that tougher for you in that you wanted that rematch so much and it was like almost dangled in front of you and then taken away?
Yeah, it was like, seriously, like someone just pulled my heart out. Like everything that I was designed to do was taken away. I had nothing in front of me. It was like empty. And it was very difficult for me to get motivated to do anything because I had been so determined that I was going to get my revenge. I was a competitor, and I've always been a competitor. And I didn't take my loss and start pounding my fists on the ground and kicking my feet. I basically went back to the gym, made myself better, got determined to get that rematch, did everything I possibly could to get people to put it together, and then all of a sudden it wasn't there anymore. It was very discouraging.
Was it a bit of at UFC 5, you guys ended up having that rematch, and unfortunately at that time there weren't any judges, but you talk to anybody that has seen that fight, had there been judges, a lot of people credit Ken Shamrock as being the better man that night at UFC 5. Did that feel like a moral victory for you at that UFC 5 and a tremendous success on pay-per-view that show doing?
Yeah, you know, the thing that really, I think, probably discouraged me the most was the fact is that they changed the rules on me. You know, they had preached so much about, you know, anybody, anywhere, anytime, no time limit, no rules. So, you know, basically I was training with guys and I was going with a fresh guy every 10 minutes and I would go for 2 hours.
Wow.
I figured I was going to wear him down, I was going to beat him down, and then I was going to submit him. Do everything they said that couldn't be done. And but then I got there and they told me, and at a meeting it was 3 days, like two days before the event, Bob Meyerowitz and Art Davies came in and sat me down and told me that they were going to put in a time limit. And I was kind of like, what's the time limit? And they said it was 30 minutes straight. And I was like, you know, that's really not enough time to do what I need to do and what I'm trained for. Hoist can do that time, and I could do that time, no problem. And I wanted to actually exhaust him, pound him, and beat him to where he couldn't lift his legs or arms, and then submit him with his own moves. And I could not do that in a half hour. I needed all 2 hours to do what I wanted to do. I trained for that. That was my plan. So when I went in to fight him, I could not change what I had trained to do. I had to stay with my program. So basically, if you saw what I did to him, that was right in the game plan to do what I wanted to do. I was beating on his ribs. I was breaking him down. He was having a hard time picking his legs up. 30 minutes ran up. And then his brother, Jorge and Gracie, said, three more minutes. And then they asked me, and I said, of course. So we went 3 more minutes, and I basically blasted him in his face, knocked him to the ground, and started beating on his body again so he'd lose his legs and lose his arms, feel have any control over him, and I kept working the body. So then when that 3 minutes ran up, he asked for 3 more minutes, and his brother was not looking too good. So I said, absolutely. So we did 3 more minutes. And basically took him down and ground and pounded him a little bit. It was getting really close to where I was going to be able to have him flat out on the mat. He could not move his body. And after that 3 minutes was up, they didn't ask for another 3 minutes. And I was a little bit disappointed because I thought they would keep going. Even though Royce was completely exhausted, probably couldn't have gone another 3 minutes. But his brother was so determined that they were going to wear me out, and it wasn't working.
Were you disappointed in Hoist that after that fight, he pretty much took himself out of the game for about a decade at that point? Were you disappointed he never came back?
I think that they saw the writing on the wall.
Yeah.
They knew that they were not going to get around me. They knew that I had figured out how to beat them, and that was to basically just wear them down, beat them down. And I had the right recipe for it, and they knew it.
Now, also, what is coming up now, Royce Gracie has been kind of on this campaign to get on the UFC 134 card in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And one name that has been coming up is a potential rematch with Royce Gracie and Ken Shamrock as a fight that people would still want to see in 2011. And I'm curious, Ken, what your thoughts are on that fight and if you would ever be interested, if that fight was offered your way, to go to Brazil and fight Royce Gracie once again.
Well, listen, it's like this. That fight, Royce Gracie and Ken Shamrock, should happen. The fans want it. I want it. Royce wants it. Brazil wants it. The only problem with that is that you have a bunch of people that have big egos who believe that the UFC, and they created this whole thing when they absolutely did not. People like myself and Royce Gracie and Coleman and many, many other people created this UFC phenomenon so that they can sit there and control it, which they're doing today, trying to control it for themselves. So they're not going to let that fight happen, because then they'll have to take it all the way back to the beginning and do a little history on it and find out that, hey, guess what? This isn't their baby. They bought it from somebody.
Why do you feel that Dana White has that belief right now? Because, I mean, on paper, a fight with Royce Gracie and Ken Shamrock, A, that is a very, I believe, big marketable fight to put on a card like that. And Royce Gracie fighting in Brazil, to me, that still does resonate in 2011. I'm surprised that they would...
Royce Gracie and Ken Shamrock fighting in Brazil.
Yeah.
This thing right now, and there's no doubt in my mind, and anybody else that would tell you, if this fight was to happen, this would be the biggest pay-per-view to date. But they will not let that happen. They would have to swallow their egos for that to happen. And these guys have got too big of egos to let that happen.
Do you feel, I mean, I imagine it has to be a source of pride for you, Ken, when you look back at the pay-per-view numbers that you generated in the early 90s, then coming back. I mean, the UFC was really, really struggling in the early portion of the last decade. You and Tito Ortiz had your first fight together. It did 150,000 buys on pay-per-view. And then 2006, you guys did 800,000 buys on pay-per-view. I mean, Ken Shamrock.
And then the TV show, basically, we beat out the Major League Baseball playoffs.
Well, I think that number was really the key to kind of television executives kind of taking wind of the UFC. I mean, you often see they don't really, I don't know, as much pay attention as to pay-per-view, but once you guys did that free television fight, that is the feud that took the UFC to a different level in 2006.
Well, check this out. There's a Royce Gracie and Ken Shamrock. I mean, we basically were the very first feud in the UFC. We built the history of the UFC. And then when the Fertittas bought the UFC, they were dying. I mean, they were struggling, and they were probably one step away from shutting it down. I come in there. I put together this fight. Actually, Dana White talks to me and about doing the Tito fight, and there's a lot of history there with the other Lionskin fighters, Guy Mesker, Jerry Bolander, so on and so on, and then a little feud with me and Tito. And I told Dana, I said, if this fight happens, I said, I could sell this thing. I said, there wouldn't be one person that wouldn't watch this when I'm done. And so Dana said, well, let me see what you can do. And I showed him what I could do and blew it up over several different ways. And then I get smacked in the face for it, because I want to go and do something with the, IFL coaching.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is something that it's a shame because it's something that is a business thing and it's become personal. And it's a shame because I think it should be put aside and you should be doing what's best for the business and what's best for the fans and not what your personal problems are.
Was there any one particular moment, Ken, where you kind of keyed in on kind of the business aspect of selling a fight? Like, you are obviously are an athlete, but you've always had that ability to be able to talk fans into whether it being selling tickets or purchasing pay-per-views. Of kind of where did you ever pick that up? Was it the professional wrestling connection? Was it over in Japan? Where did you key in on that aspect of the business?
I'm not sure that I ever really learned anything. I'm just it's kind of my personality. It's much, you know, I try to find what I can find in people that makes me mad at them, and then I just pick on it and pick on it. And it comes out of my interviews, and it comes out of my fight press conferences. But when it's over, it's all gone, too. So I've got that I've got the edginess where I'm very angry, and I want to tear somebody's head off, and I make myself that angry. But then when it's over, I've got that other side to me, too, where it's like, hey, shake hands and let's have fun.
Is that kind of where you and Tito left things off after that final fight? It was something where, I mean, you guys had a lot of animosity going into those fights, but together, you two did a lot of great business together. Was there kind of that that mutual respect at the end of those three fights?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was very, very angry at him, and there's no question that I had looked at him and I found so many things to make me angry at him, and I let it go. I let it go out. But after that, I also knew that when it was over, the better man won, and that's just the way it is. Move on with life and, you know, find out what's next.
Yeah, it's just so interesting that, you know, that Ken Shamrock, Tito Ortiz feud. I mean, each fight had a lot of significance. And I would say the first one, I mean, you guys did such a giant number at that point that I think it gave confidence in Zuffa that, you know, we can make this work. And had that fight not happened, I mean, who knows if Zuffa might have just cashed in at that point and kind of given up on things. I mean, it really could have changed history and where mixed martial arts went in this country.
There's no doubt, you know, and it's, like I said, it's a shame that they can't put the personal stuff behind them and do what's best for business, you know? I mean, it's like, come on, people, there's so many people that should be involved in the UFC right now that help build it to where it's at. You know, they got Chuck Liddell in an office in Zuffa, you know, doing I don't know what, and I God bless him. I'm glad they've taken care of him, but what about the rest of the guys?
Yeah,
that help put this together. You know, they're basically just showing them, and it's not right. It's not fair because you look what NFL does and what baseball does, Major League Baseball and hockey is. They try and keep these guys somewhat involved, the ones that have actually made a difference in the sport, and they try and keep them involved. They respect them and they take care of them. UFC does not do that.
Do you think we'll ever see the day, Ken, where we see a fighters union, or is that something where it's similar to pro wrestling, where you're never going to get that many guys onto the same page and fighting for the same cause? Because, I mean, no one wants to see any of these fighters that are not taken care of later in life. Could we ever see a union?
I don't think so, because you have too many guys that are actually fighting, that are making money right now, that really won't look past someone pet them right now. You know what I mean? It's like mm-hmm. The money's coming in, and they're not going to kind of blow that because it's an individual thing, and it's all about me. And, you know, sorry things didn't work out for you, but this is my time right now, and I'm not going to blow it. Not understanding that their time is also coming around the corner, and they're going to be treated the same way.
Yeah, I completely agree. Well, Ken, I just want to finish things off with one last question, and that is, Bob Shamrock, who you mentioned earlier in the interview, passing away recently, and I just want to get some of your thoughts on just the impact that Bob had, not just on your career, but your life. I mean, just such an amazing figure.
My father basically saved my life. If it wasn't for him, I would either be in prison or dead. And he's done that for so many kids out there. He was an extreme, extreme individual. He gave everything to the kids and helped them. And in fact, he gave so much that he left nothing for himself. He really drained himself. And, you know, it was hard because we brought him home and, you know, he passed away in my house.
Mm-hmm.
But he chose that he didn't want to. He couldn't go on with the way that he was going. He lost his leg. His body was deteriorating. He couldn't walk. They had him on IVs all the time. He couldn't get out of bed. And he basically just said, "Ken, I can't live like this." And you know, basically asked my permission. And I was like, "Pop, man, this is not about me. It's about you. And if this is something you can't do, man, maybe it's time to go home." And so, you know, he made that decision, and I brought him up and put the bed up in my room, and, you know, we spent the last 2 or 3 days of his life, you know, sitting in my room and talking. So we had a good time, and he was a wonderful individual. And one thing that I have on his urn, and that we had his funeral, the motto of his funeral was, "He made the world a better place," and that's the truth.
Yeah, that completely is. I mean, just made such a big difference in so many people's lives, and of course, yourself included there, Ken. Well, I want to thank you, Ken, for spending this time with us. And, you know, what is next for Ken Shamrock? I mean, are there any fights you are targeting right now? I mean, obviously, the Hoist fight, that is what a lot of people are buzzing about online. I know you maybe are skeptical that it might happen, but when would you like to fight next, Ken?
I don't have anything set in my mind. I'm always training. I'm in shape. I like to kind of enjoy training other people. My kids are starting to really get interested in it and train. So I'm enjoying that part of it. You know, I enjoy promoting fights. We got a couple of fights that we're looking at promoting. We got some stuff going in South Africa. I do some ministry work. I love doing that, working with the youth. So that's kind of what I'm doing right now, is I'm just really working with the youth, working at some group homes, dealing with some troubled youth, you know, stuff that I really enjoy doing. And if a fight comes up, you know, I think most people know me and who I'm about. I love to fight. I want to fight. I think staying within my capabilities of fighting people that were from my time, I think, you know, it's okay to do that. If I try to fight these young kids, you know, that's obviously I'm a little bit old for that. Mm-hmm. But if I stay within my realm of things, I think that fans would enjoy it. I would enjoy it, and I think it's good for the sport.
What about professional wrestling, Ken? Is that something that interests you at all at this stage of your life, or is that something that is part of your past at this point?
No, at this point, I think it's part of my past. You know, unless somebody comes up with something that's interesting. But at this point in time, I think that's part of my past.
All right. Well, Ken, thanks so much for joining us. Myself, personally, I really hope that at some point we can see the UFC and Ken Shamrock back together in some capacity. You are a tremendous ambassador for the sport, and I think that would be a great role for you, because you cannot tell the story of the UFC without the name Ken Shamrock, and I think a lot of fans are aware of that, and I think it's ridiculous that these two sides are not together at this point.
Yeah, you know, and like I said, there's always two sides to a story, you know, so whether I'm right or they're right, I think that's irrelevant. I think the bottom line is just putting it behind and moving forward.
I agree. I think it's, you know, for the sake of the sport, I think it would be a very strong united front that we should see with Ken Shamrock involved with the UFC in whatever capacity it could be. So, Ken, thank you.
Well, the thing, too, is it's about the fans. It's about the fans. They're the ones that you need to be listening to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just see up here in Toronto right now with, like, the UFC Fan Expo going on. I mean, how cool would it be if, you know, you could go there, meet Ken Shamrock, meet Hoyce Gracie, meet some of the legends from the early days of the UFC as kind of your connection to the UFC of the present right now. Look at the guys who kind of got this thing up and rolling. I mean, that's, to me, is a huge part of the whole story of mixed martial arts within this country, is looking at the people that really did pave the way for this still very young sport.
Isn't that the way it's supposed to happen?
It should be. You would hope it could.
Right.
Well, Ken, thanks again for all this time, and we wish you all of the best, and I hope we can chat sometime in the future again. This has been a great time.
All right. Thanks, brother.
All right. Thanks, Ken.
Bye. God bless.
So what did you think of that way?
I can't believe you got a chance to talk to him. That's
would
wonderful.
You be interested in Hoyce Gracie, Ken Shamrock in Rio de Janeiro? Or is that too much of a freak show for the UFC at this point in time?
They put James Toney in there, and so I don't think anything. Dana really has no credibility anymore.
If you're going to put Hoyce on a card, Shamrock would be the guy I'd want to see.
Sure.
I don't want to see Matt Hughes fight him, and he's not going to fight him. I don't see any interest in a guy off the welterweight roster fighting.
I would actually love to see that.
I mean, I would like to see Ken and UFC back on good terms together.
Because Ken's not going to get knocked out. You don't have to worry about that. And, yeah, it'll be fun.
It'll be a fun fight.
It'll be safe.
Of all the people, when you look at the most important people in UFC's history, I mean, Ken, to me, is right at the top of that
list.
Because, you know, as much as you can say about what Couture and Liddell meant, you take Ken Shamrock out. If you take out the Ken Hoyce feud and the Ken Tito feud, I don't think the Zuffas would have committed to the UFC much past 2003 or 4. Mm-hmm. I think they would have bailed out at that point.
Do you think if Ken had just retired completely and kind of,
if he hadn't gone to coach in the IFL, I think he would have stayed on good terms with them. And
if he didn't go for that, what is it, Barry, what was that, the dude that he fought? Buzz Berry, if he didn't go into that fight, if he didn't tarnish his career pretty much, would he still be regarded as...
And then he sued the company.
Yeah.
I mean, he made some bad decisions, unfortunately. But I just think a guy like that, it's just, to me, the history book, you can't tell the UFC story without Ken Shamrock. And you would like to see him in some kind of ambassador role or just connected with the company and know that this guy is financially set for life for what this guy has put into the company despite some bad decisions he has made in his career. Mm-hmm. So a big thank you to Ken Shamrock for chatting with us. That was a really, really interesting chat, and I think the perfect person to have on this show. So let's get into some feedback, Wade, and then we'll get out of here because
I know a lot of people here want to hear what we're going to review next week on the show. And let's start off with Eric Creamer. I ordered this event on pay-per-view with my cousin, that being UFC 1. I remember the show fondly for many reasons, one of them being it was the first pool we ever did for a wrestling event. Oh, he's talking about Barely Legal. I'm sorry, not UFC. I was a pool for a wrestling event. Great fun then, and great fun still to this day. Two blank VHS tapes well spent. I can only pray that one day Pollock will open his eyes to the greatness that is Dragon Ball Z. From Eric Creamer.
No, that's not what he wrote.
Yeah, it is.
He wrote Creamer Dai Mao.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
I can't pronounce it.
I don't know. If that's
so I was just going to ignore it.
That's a Dragon Ball Z reference beyond me. Sorry. Howard Paul Stober. Hi, guys. Just finished listening to the Barely Legal review. Another top-class show. Going back to the event, the show certainly blew away WWF's In Your House event of the same month. I think the show drew about a 0.25 pay-per-view buy rate, which I would imagine is more than what TNA does today. Even more impressive, considering the show was only available in the region of 15 million homes, about less 10 million less than WWF and WCW at the time. Looking back at the old ECW pay-per-views, most of the matches were of a good quality, and the only things I never really enjoyed was the Dudleys and the Gangsters and their hardcore brawls. I think the Dudleys really improved their wrestling when they joined the WWF, which was quite impressive as it's normally the other way around. Looking forward to the UFC review as it's not a product I know too much about.
Oh, this name's going to be tough. Ciaran Highland. Way referencing Son Goku in relation to Lance Storm's stupid rat tail. Total win.
It's Son Goku.
Son Goku. Is it like the Japanese MMA company? Sen Goku.
No, nothing like that. Patrick McCarley. Regarding Barely Legal, Kai and Tai wearing BWO shirts was meant as a parody of NWO Japan. It was supposed to be funny that the BWO had their own Japanese spinoff group, just like the NWO in WCW.
Daniel McKinnon. I can remember being blown away by the Barely Legal opening match the first time I saw it, around the time Saturn was fading out of the WWE. I can see in hindsight that it lacked flow and psychology, but man, it was just what I was looking for at the time. It was the first time I had seen the Eliminators and one of the first times I saw ECW.
Aram Nasrallah. Is there any bigger withdrawal than Pacquiao?
Fight draw.
Sorry. Is there any bigger fight draw than Pacquiao right now? I love MMA more than boxing, but watching the Primetime series and Fight Camp 360, they do a much better job on building the match on Fight Camp, and they both have the same storyline with challenger nobody believes in, and they do take shots at MMA with Bob Arum mentioning that the fighters deserve their purse money. Surely these types of shows makes them a bigger star, but why haven't WWE done anything like this yet? Next year's WrestleMania main event with John Cena and Rock could easily be more interesting with this type of build-up. So my question is... Excuse me. Bill Wallace, moment. So my question is, both of you, that if you do watch the boxing programs, do they make you want to watch their fights? And what's your take on WWE if they did one of these?
WWE and O have talked about it, and Cena Rock would make sense if you were going to do that. I know it's been talked about.
Now how would you do it, though? How would you do it?
TNA did a pretty good job a few years back for Bound for Glory, where, especially for the main event, it was like you're not trying to put it over as much that wrestling is legit, but, I mean, you can totally build up a match. So, within that context.
So would you do it in character? Would they be cutting promos on each other in character, or would you be sure?
I think it'd be a much more serious tone. Like, you wouldn't have Rock doing his catchphrases and stuff
right.
to a camera.
But they would be in character.
To a degree. But, I mean, you know, it's like Steve Austin doing something. Is that really in character? It's very close to his personality. That's how you have to try and play it off. I wouldn't want the goofy John Cena.
Yeah, they would
do a very serious presentation.
They would have to play up the reality and whatever their feud is.
But Manny Pacquiao, without question, is the biggest draw in combat sports right now. And his fight with Shane Mosley next weekend is going to be the most purchased fight card of 2011, unless he were to have another fight later this year with a bigger opponent. But they do a pretty good job on the
they do an awesome job.
On 24/7 and
Fight
over
Camp 360,
for Fight Camp 360.
Which we air on the Fight Network.
Which we do, because that's a huge story was Pacquiao and his camp moving over to Showtime. I mean, that's a giant shift in power.
If you're a fan of documentary, sports documentaries, or it really is a shame that, you know what, I can't say that because like wrestling has seen its fair share of great documentaries too. If you're a fan of any of that stuff, these shows are like my favorite thing. They're my absolute favorite thing.
Are we going to review Pacquiao Mosley next week?
Yes, we will. You just gave it away.
We won't. Don't worry, everybody. Stephen Smith. I'll probably tune into next week's review for the intro and the feedback, but honestly, that's it. Wrestling appeals to me because it caters to my creative side in a way that mainstream sports does not. No matter what it may be, if it's competitive, I generally don't enjoy it. I'd like to keep an open mind, as John said, but I can't see myself being engrossed in any MMA event.
Okay. Hope you enjoyed this feedback. Warren Cantor, I'll probably download it and listen, but I honestly don't have quite the same enthusiasm this time around compared to a WWF or WCW review. I can appreciate MMA and am open to it, but generally there's not a lot of it here for me to watch, and I would rather download wrestling when possible if given a choice over MMA. The Jacob review was okay, but a little underwhelming in that I know nobody on that show besides Benoit, Sasuke, and Guerrero. Hoping for a return to form for the next podcast.
Very heated debate amongst our listeners this week. Scott McCullough. Well, here's my two cents. If you don't enjoy UFC or basically MMA in general, just don't listen to this week's review. No one is forcing you to download it. It's the simple violence on TV argument. Have a nice day. Me personally, I enjoy John Away's look at things in general, so bring on more review Away.
Mm-hmm. Thulani, Mabuza, and Cube. We are all past thinking that wrestling is a legit sport. In fact, the fact that it's a work is the reason we're fans and enjoy review Away, because we enjoy the critique of the product. We enjoy how John and Wake deconstruct each wrestling show on all levels. I'm an MMA fan, and I'm not stoked about the idea of a UFC 1 review, simply because at the end of the day, UFC will either be reviewed as if it were a wrestling show, which will piss off the MMA fan in me, or it'll be reviewed as a straight-up fight show, which equals a 45-minute snore fest.
I disagree. I think you can review anything in whatever context you were. I found the Super J Cup to be more of a straight sports presentation than UFC 1 mm-hmm. by leaps and bounds. Yeah. And I mean, that show, I think we got more feedback for that J Cup show than any other I think we've done. Mm-hmm. So, and positive. So whatever, everyone has their own rights to their thing, but I mean, me and Way are MMA fans as well, so yeah. You know, on certain weeks we're going to review MMA.
And I really was not about to watch a WCW pay-per-view this week, I'm sorry.
Especially this week. It's just the nail in the coffin for you.
Yeah.
Sean Prasad, I'm amazed at the time invested from the people who have been complaining over the UFC 1 review. There isn't a gun being put to your head to listen to the review, and I understand you want to get your point across and express your distaste for MMA, but isn't one post enough? We get it. You don't like MMA.
Paul Granke, I don't personally enjoy MMA. A little too violent for my taste, but the fact of the matter is that this podcast provides us with hours of free entertainment without cramming ads down our throats or trying to get us to subscribe to a website. Who are we to complain? Besides, this is much more valid than the knucklehead review.
Yeah, the violent argument is fine for those, but on the week after we reviewed Barely Legal, this was only slightly more violent.
Dennis, well, that's not real. They're not really getting hurt.
Yeah, that's right.
Not real blood.
Nope. Dennis Amaya, excellent review this past week, guys. I'm glad to hear that you are going to review UFC 1. After hearing the positive feedback that you got for the Super J Cup review with W.H. Park, who was great, by the way, I was wondering if you could review other types of combat sports like Pride or maybe even Lucha Libre. It would be great to hear your perspective on both. Anyway, can't wait to hear the review of UFC 1, which was the odd tournament, to say the least. Thanks for everything. Can review Pride Bushido with Alberto Del Rio against Mirko Krokop.
Yeah, that would be a short review. Dustin Thompson, the first few UFC pay-per-views were great. I liked the format. Because when I first started watching UFC, I started really late, and I was so jacked because of how the first few were. Then they changed. And it just ends there.
That's where it ends. Well, yeah, they got out of the tournament format after
a number of that was a very successful format, but it just got to be a little unrealistic. I mean, you cannot be fighting three times in one night. It's just, it might be an easy, digestible show, and there's the arguments for it, but I personally, I'm a much bigger fan of the current format. Mm-hmm. John Funk. Hey, John and Wei, I have two questions for you this week. One, MMA, and one, wrestling. Firstly, how do you think Ken Shamrock would hold up today if you were to take him at his prime, early UFC, and put him in against guys of today? Watching old Shamrock fights recently, this guy was a machine when he was younger, and when the UFC was more barbaric than today. Also, was Rick Rude training for an in-ring comeback when he died? I've read that he was, and why he was out of the ring for so long. Three questions, I guess. Thank you. First of all, Rick Rude had suffered like a career-ending, or what he had thought a career-ending injury, but he was training for a comeback with WCW in 1999 when he died that year, and he was absolutely planning a comeback. Ken Shamrock today, I think the sport is just so much more evolved. You can't compare it. I mean, Ken Shamrock and the Lion's Den, I mean, they were training without any of the knowledge the current camps have of getting everything down so much to a science that it's Ken was a very good submission fighter, but it's just impossible to compare to today. It's just so many more advancements and the fighters have learned just so many more techniques that it's two different sports, in my opinion. It's just a complete crapshoot.
Yeah.
What was the other question in here? It was about
Rick Rude and
why he was out of the ring for so long was an injury. Henzo Flores. Oh, sorry, that's yours.
Henzo Flores. UFC holds a fond memory in my heart, and I actually started watching it in Peru, where they showed the pay-per-views for free, I believe, on TV. I must have been around 7 or 8 noticing this guy Hoist in a jiu-jitsu gi destroying the competition, and this other guy Shamrock tearing it up. The last UFC show I remember watching was Hoist having to forfeit the match against the Beast, I believe. When I left Peru in early 1997, I had no way of watching UFC unless we paid pay-per-view, and around the late 97-98, I started watching Stone Cold Steve Austin, The Undertaker, Sable, Mark Merrill, and all these characters, and I was a fan of the WWF instantly, possibly because, like John has mentioned, it drew you in and you cared about the characters like you cared to see Gracie's first defeat, or you cared to see Stone Cold get his revenge. Good times. Looking forward to the podcast this Sunday. Keep the podcast coming. You are doing the Lord's work, John and Wei.
The Lord's work.
Yeah.
We do work on a Sunday.
And I think that's a rare instance of a fan going over from MMA to wrestling.
Yeah, you very rarely get that.
Yeah,
crossover. Reginald Smithlington Thomas. Am I really the only one who still looks forward to the draft? Even before WrestleMania this year, where there appeared to be an intentional attempt to ignore the separate rosters as much as possible, the bulk of the rosters still only appeared on one show. It wasn't just jobbers either. The biggest main eventers were consistently appearing on both shows, and there were a few mid-carders who would make a random appearance here or there, but that was it. With the draft now in the rearview mirror, they will most likely make the lines stronger, if for no other reason than to pretend it matters for at least a while. There will be several fresh feuds, and several stale ones will come to an end, and that can only be a good thing. Most of all, with Sheamus seemingly now being the biggest heel on SmackDown, that may get him back to the level he never should have relinquished.
He's not the biggest heel on SmackDown. Come on. He's a mid-carder.
They positioned him pretty well on Friday.
What did they do?
He just murdered Kofi Kingston. And
another mid-carder.
Well, we'll see what they do. I much rather see Christian and Sheamus than Christian and Mark Henry.
This is the same Sheamus that lost to... who did he lose to on Raw?
Evan Bourne.
Yeah.
Well...
No. He lost to somebody else.
He got beat by Evan Bourne in like seconds. Remember when Evan Bourne made his comeback?
No, he lost on Raw this past Monday during the draft episode.
Oh, that's right.
Did he lose to Kofi? I don't remember. It seemed like such a long time.
I know. Dude, this Raw feels like weeks and weeks ago. You're up.
Oh, Nate Milton. TNate. Just listening to Review Raw, and Brother Pollock hit on something that I've been harping on for at least a year. TNA needs Jim Ross. As much as TNA wants fans want Heyman to come in, myself included, JR would be the most valuable commodity that TNA could add to the company. Besides the obvious input he could have on the creative side of things, he would be an absolute boost on the commentary team, and he'd be an invaluable asset to the development of young talent. As much as I respect Jim Ross's loyalty to WWE, it has been made painfully obvious that the company no longer values a legend like good old JR. They value him. I mean, they're willing to pay him money. They're probably to pay him a lot more money than what TNA is.
And finally, Sean McAllister. So after hunting online, I was able to find the Bret Hart documentary John and Wade did and was very impressed. As a fan who's just getting back into wrestling after only attending a few house shows for the last few years, it was really interesting. Maybe it's because I'm from the UK, but to finally see a lot of the clips and people featured on the documentary was the most impressive part. For the longest time, the Hart family were mostly just names to me, and it was refreshing to finally put faces to those names. While the entire family have commented many times on the screw job, having it on film as a companion to Wrestling with Shadows makes for interesting watching, since that film showed the situation when feelings were still very raw. Sure, you get a lot of the same comments when you read Bret Hart's book about the last few years of his life, but there's clearly so much more to it when put on film with an actual voice filled with emotion. And we did not pay Sean for that message.
Thanks.
So thank you.
Thank you very much, Sean. Yeah, for those of you who are unaware, with the Bret Hart doc John and I worked on just recently re-aired, and I want to thank everybody for the comments that you've been sending. Myself and John Pollock.
Yes, a big thank you, and I'm hoping we will have some bigger release of Survival of the Hitman.
That's right. It's still one of the things that I'm most proud of.
As am I. I mean, the fact we put that thing together in 3 months is something that I still shake my head at. I went to Hot Docs last week, and just hearing like the amount of time. Some of these filmmakers have put into their documentaries. Like I watched one where it was a 2.5 year process, and I don't know. Maybe it's a bit of me being a bit of a.
There are different styles and different types of documentaries too.
Yeah, but I watched this one documentary, and I just thought to myself, it's like, I feel you and I could do this. You know what I mean? I think once you actually put your ideas onto paper and make it happen.
We're geniuses.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
We're
maybe I'm a little overconfident right now. But nonetheless, I just feel that that's something I think you and me definitely want to continue into the future, because I think we did a really good job with that along with George Barbosa.
Yeah.
And it turned out very well for Fight Network. So
yes.
Let's wrap things up right now before we continue to just talk about ourselves and how great we are.
Okay.
We're going to finish things off. I asked everyone online, you can pick what we review next week. So the people have spoken, and the most votes was for One Night Stand 2006, the second year of One Night Stand. So we did review the first One Night Stand
a couple of months back.
Very fun show. This was before they had completely prostituted the brand and was actually 2 days before they would relaunch ECW on Sci-Fi. So we will review One Night Stand 2006, maybe find somebody. And we will be back next week. And Wei, a big thank you to you. You worked an incredible schedule this past
you
week.
You too. You too, John. We everybody here at the Fight Network, we logged in a lot of extra hours, and you will continue to do so tonight even. You just did.
I feel I'm going to share something with everybody right now.
Okay.
We are recording this Sunday afternoon. We have not seen the pay-per-view as of yet, Wei.
What are you talking about? Are you sure you want to do this?
It's Sunday at 6 o'clock right now. And me and Wei, today was our day off. And we came in here at 11 a.m.
Yeah.
We're recording this at 6 p.m. Well, this day became just insane today.
Yeah, we usually record these on Thursday during office hours, but I personally just had so much stuff to do that I didn't have time to watch this show. And so I watched it really just this morning after I got home from the UFC post-fight press conference. And it's just been a really long, long day.
I am completely exhausted right now, and I have to go now watch a 3-hour pay-per-view.
Damn,
and then we got
man.
The law coming up afterwards, and then I have to be at work for 8:30 tomorrow. But nonetheless, I'm just prefacing this all.
Why do you have to be at work at 8:30?
Yeah, we got to do our pay-per-view rundown.
Oh, yeah. Jesus.
And we got to do updates.
If you guys want to know how you can support, just watch. Just watch our stuff. Let us know that
it's
worthwhile.
That's all we want. So, everyone, thank you for listening. We appreciate it. One Night Stand 2006 is coming up next week. And Wei Ting, just sing us a song.
We just can't. Oh, this is the most depressing end to a podcast ever.
I'm tired right now.
I'm
it really hit me
too,
here.
Man.
I'm going to have a coffee, to be honest.
Okay.
Oh, you want to quickly...
I also wanted to quickly just thank the people that I ran into at the UFC Fan Expo that are listeners of this, especially one fan, Daniel, who took a photo with me. Mm-hmm. Very nice of him to come up and had some great words about the law and review away. Yeah. And also the fans I got to meet on Friday night at the Spaghetti Factory that listened to the show. Myself, Dan Lavransky, and Jason Agnew, we got to go hang out with Dave Meltzer, Brian Alvarez, Todd Martin, and some of the F4W Empire. So that was a great, great time.
Just the aura that must have emanated out of that building that night.
A lot of wrestling talk. Kevin Ioli was also there from Yahoo Sports. I had a great time. Really, really good time.
And where can listeners, if they're curious, learn more about your weekend and your time with the Figure Four Wrestling Observer?
Yes. Group. Got to meet longtime listener Rodney Rogers.
Yeah.
Good guy.
And
really
where can
guy.
People find out more about this? Aren't you going to be talking about this? Oh, wait, never mind. You're not.
What are you talking about?
I thought you were going to be on Byte Radio, but obviously not. It's 6 o'clock right now.
Yeah, that won't be happening.
Never mind.
So. I'm off to watch Extreme Rules. Are you coming?
Are you having dinner somewhere?
We're going to order food.
At 7? Okay. Yeah.
You want to come?
I'll stick around.
All right.
Maybe. Yeah, I'll stick around.
You're lying to me because we're on the air. I'm going to hit stop, and you're going to be like, I got to go home. Well, you're welcome to come, Way. Free food is always a benefit.
Yeah, I'll join.
I'm starving.
I'm starving right now, though. I don't know if I can hold out till 8 o'clock. That's the only thing. So,
I got time right now because it's only...
Well, do you want to get something to eat?
We could do that, and then we could go to... Because it's only 5:53 right now.
Yeah.
Jay and Dan will get over at like 7:30. And we can eat something now.
We can.
Oh, I got to edit this fucking thing. I can do that in my house.
Oh, yeah.
That's okay.
To you, man.
What song do you want to go with?
I'm sorry. Let's...
In honor of Mark Bocek. Why don't we go with that?
No, nobody knows about that.
Let's, in honor of Drake being at UFC 129, let's go with your favorite rapper.
Okay. Whatever.
I only know one song by Drake.
I don't know any songs by Drake.
All right, so we're going to go with Drake?
Yeah.
Okay, here's Drake.
No. Let's go. Let me just get my mind proper, because I'm just so
okay, you let me know,
exhausted.
And we'll go out with it.
Okay.
Because that will end.
This whole time, he won't even break a smile.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for watching the first Ultimate Fighting Championship. Hopefully what you saw tonight was something that was very enjoyable for you, very enlightening for you. I hope you had a wonderful time. Thank you very much for coming. We'll see you next time. For Jim Brown, for Kathy Long,
Machado. Don't forget
for Brian. Brian, what were you doing here?
Kill me.
You have not been a champion of anything ever. What were you doing here?
I can tell the viewers, the listeners, what it is like in this ring and outside the ring. And I'm a thumb wrestling champion.
I think you bribed your way.
Stay there for a couple minutes, please.
Stay there in a couple of minutes?
Yes.
All right. I'll see you guys after.
Okay,
thank you
care.
Very much, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you had a wonderful evening. For Jim... For Kathy, for Rod, and myself, Bill Wallace, thank you very much. Good evening.
All right. Paige, I hope you don't mind me just having a little fun, you know. I know that you're joining. I always like the song, so I figured I may as well go in. Shit. Here we go.
I'm still fly.
Yeah.
I'm sky high and I dare anybody to try and cut my wings. I'm still pulling out the phantom and these haters can't stand
me. That's me singing,
I'm
by the way.
Still doing
yes,
my
you didn't
thing.
Know.
I'm still fly.
Yeah.
I'm sky
some new shit. Some new shit I'm on.
Anybody to try and cut my wings.
I promise I got 'em though.
I'm still shutting cities down.
Love.
Every time I come around, nigga, I'm still doing
yeah,
my thing. I'm still.
Responsible for everything you listen to. Why mediocre talent proceeds to try and condition you. Took over my city and I never asked permission to. Started popping bottles cause it's ATF tradition to. Celebrated by my fuck them at the Soho. If they ain't an elevator in it, it's a no-go. Coldest thing dropping and these bitches wanna snow blow. And they just give me head while the haters give me promo. And man, my DJ should've won that. But listen and respect, man, the city owes
us one back. All these old heads keep their minds on one track. And me, I run Toronto, holla at me when you're done laps. Roll around with Nico, party with Azuka. Shot goes out the Wonder, shot goes out the Future, shot goes out the Get It, motherfucker, I am ready. And whoever got the torch just can't seem to hold it steady, cause I see the flame flickering, ex-girls bickering. Got these women jocking me from Heartland Grove to Pickering. I tried to send my nigga short some syrup out of Michigan, but my connect said it'll take a minute if you're listening. Please start doing you, I've been doing me, and I'm a staple in my city, you can never ruin me. Rappers are emotional, critics be reviewing me, but I got love for everybody, even if you're suing me. My brother P. Ray knows, we fuck with the same hoes, plus he taught me how to spot an officer in plain clothes. Staring at you pussy niggas, all I see is rainbows. Hopping on the jet to every single Little Wayne show, me and Little Jazzy. Please do not harass me, just holler if you got me, and fuck you if you have me. Shot goes out to Brian E., shout out to Photo Will, shout out to Oliver and 40, man, you know the deal. Shout out to Mayhem, shout out to P Plus. The names I mention are crucial, you gonna need us. And life is good, everything is just fine. I am so sure of my rhymes, I could sacrifice a line like oh yeah. I swear I really fucking does it. I had these niggas tripping, no luggage. I'm still fly, I'm sky high, and I dare anybody to try and cut my wings. I'm still pulling out the phantom, and these haters can't stand them, nigga. I'm still doing my thing. I'm still fly, I'm sky high, yeah. And I dare anybody to try and cut my wings. I'm still shutting cities down every time I come around, nigga. I'm still doing my thing. I'm still, Drizzy's home, baby. Nico just came to school me from the airport like 3 hours ago. I still got my hotel slippers on and shit. So, you know, I'm ready, though. It's October's very own .blogspot.com. That's where you find all the exclusives at. You know, October's very own. We got the real-life entourage. It's like me, Freako Suave, Olivier the Parisian Gangster, 4040, John B. Know what it is, man. Lebanon Don's in this bitch. You already? Yeah. You can tell I'm at the point where I'm on a ride. I really don't give a fuck right now. I'll tell you that much, baby. Huh? Here I go, baby. Here I go. It's not that I'm an asshole. I just live behind a tent. I don't see you. Tents provided by Mosley Tribe, by the way. Shout out to Mosley Tribe. Shout out to Ransom, MGZ. I see you, boy. Yeah. Should I stop? Here I go.